The problem lay in our mindset. Our White House team had already weathered many disasters, from the hurricanes of the previous year all the way back to the unprecedented calamity of 9/11. As a result, we were probably a little numb. What, another tragedy? And perhaps a little complacent. We've been through this before. We assumed that local and federal officials would do their usual yeoman's work at minimizing the devastation, much as the more seasoned Florida officials had done the year before, and we recalled how President Bush had excelled at reassuring and comforting the nation in the wake of past calamities. Instead of planning and acting for the potential worst-case scenario, we took a chance that Katrina would not be as unmanageable, overwhelming, or catastrophic as it turned out. So we allowed our institutional response to go on autopilot. Rather than seizing the initiative and getting in front of what was happening on the ground in New Orleans, we let events control us. It was a costly blunder. And things soon got a lot worse. One horrific media storyline, a tale of indifference, would soon be joined by another, a tale of incompetence. Over the next 3 days, as the government's response to Katrina proved to be slow and inadequate, the press and the public would link the image of a seemingly carefree president with the news of his administration's clumsy management of the disaster, creating a narrative of government failure that would be irresistible and, once established, practically indelible. As of that Tuesday morning, however, we had no idea what was about to hit us. We blithely headed to Texas to get our belongings and a good night's rest before departing for D.C. the following day. Meanwhile, thousands of people were stranded in attics and on rooftops or elsewhere in New Orleans, waiting for help with little more than the clothes on their bodies. Hospitals filled with gravely ill patients were losing power. Makeshift shelters, including the New Orleans Superdome and the Convention Center, were filling up with tens of thousands of displaced people, hungry, sick, and scared. Conflicting, confusing accounts filtering out of the city added to the sense of chaos. People were talking about widespread looting, rioting, armed bands of thugs terrorizing the city. Some of these stories eventually proved overblown, but at the time, it was impossible to sort fact from fiction. The substantive problems the Bush White House had to address were huge and pressing. It didn't help that a parallel public relations disaster was unfolding. Sometime Wednesday morning, I learned that Karl Rove, still pushing his ill-conceived suggestion from Tuesday's conference call, had actually persuaded the president to do a flyover of the Katrina disaster area. Dan Bartlett and I talked about it by phone. I still stressed that it was a bad idea. Dan did not disagree, but indicated Carl was convinced we needed to do it, and the president agreed. There was little fight left in me. My will to push back had been severely diminished in the aftermath of the recent media flare-up over my earlier assertions in the Plame affair. I shrugged it all off and went along. I did not bring it up with the president. I knew it was a mistake, but I had no idea how devastating the image would turn out to be. Before we took off from Crawford, I briefed reporters on the tarmac. I explained how the president had held a video conference on hurricane relief efforts from his ranch. I emphasized that the president was focused first and foremost on saving lives, and second, on developing a long-term strategy for addressing the needs of hundreds of thousands of displaced citizens. Then we boarded Air Force One for the flight to Washington, including the flyover Karl Rove had insisted on. From a technical standpoint, the flyover proceeded beautifully. As Air Force One neared New Orleans, it descended to a lower altitude, and the president moved from his private cabin to the left side of the plane, where the head of his Secret Service detail normally sits. This location provided him the best view of Katrina's devastation. He was joined by Karl Rove, Deputy National Security Advisor J.D. Crouch, one of the pilots, and me. The still photographers in the pool were brought forward to snap shots for a couple of minutes, while Bush looked out over the inundated Crescent City. In all, we spent about 35 minutes flying at about 2,500 feet over New Orleans and the Mississippi coastal cities of Slidell, Waveland, Pasquistion, Gulfport, Biloxi, and Pascagoula. In Waveland and Pasquistion, slabs of concrete were left where wooden houses had once stood. The debris, looking from the air like nothing more than piles of matchsticks as far as the eye could see, as described in the pool report by Washington Post reporter Peter Baker. The mood in the cabin was somber. All of us, including the president, were struck by just how devastating the storm had been. Newscasts that night included pictures of Bush gazing out the window, and the following morning, newspapers across the country followed suit. The image I most feared was captured in each picture. Authors Wayne Slater and James Moore summed it up succinctly in their book, The Architect, Karl Rove and the Master Plan for Absolute Power. Quote, "The photo of Bush gazing out the window in the gentle half-light amid the security and considerable comfort of Air Force One, peering down on a city lost and ruined and rapidly descending into chaos, dominated the front pages the next morning. It was among the most damaging photos of his presidency. The president appeared detached and powerless, unable even to comprehend how he might use the government to help his own people. Worse, the picture conveyed no sense that the president cared or was worried about the catastrophe unfolding beneath the aircraft's big wings. My earlier briefing with the press pool mattered little after the photos hit the news wires. The picture I had drawn was of a president deeply concerned and fully engaged. Photos of him peering down from Air Force One at people stranded by the floodwaters below painted a very different image. It was quite an object lesson in the supreme power of images in today's visually oriented world. The president was certainly moved by the devastation he witnessed during the flyover, but it's impossible to truly feel the agony of those below from the luxury and comfort of Air Force One. Real empathy can only happen when meeting victims face to face. Bush fully grasped Katrina's destructiveness during our first visit to the region a couple of days later, although even then, he didn't meet those in New Orleans who'd suffered the most. The way we define leadership in America today is a funny thing. It demands strength, steadfastness, and resolve, as well as an unwavering focus on the duties at hand. But it also involves visible displays of emotion, empathy, compassion, and sorrow. Softer qualities that may conflict with the toughness we expect from our leaders. Bush understood both of these roles, and in addressing the demands of his office, he had come to rely on his uncanny ability to compartmentalize, to wall off within himself the varying emotional and psychological responses triggered by the multitude of challenging issues facing him every day. This strategy enabled him to exhibit calm, steady leadership during times of crisis. Bush regarded such calm as one sign of a disciplined leader who focuses on making hard decisions and wisely delegating responsibilities, in the manner of an effective corporate CEO. And by this point in his presidency, having lived through a number of trying crises, he knew how easy it could be to let emotion overpower him and paralyze his thinking. It happened to another Texan president, Lyndon Johnson, during the height of Vietnam. Bush was determined not to let it happen to him, either from war abroad or catastrophe at home. For Bush, being a strong leader in a time of crisis means not allowing himself to be overwhelmed with anguish or anxiety. It means working to solve problems coolly, deliberately, and strategically. But as a result, he sometimes seems disconnected from the realities of people's lives. And that's what happened in Katrina's wake. People across the country were witnessing horrific images on their television sets, dead bodies floating in the floodwaters or lying face down on the pavement, families stranded on rooftops, calling out for food and water, people huddled under cardboard boxes for shelter. Bush needed to show that he was in control, but he also needed to show that he cared, that he understood the situation and shared American's sense of horror and anger, that he was determined to do whatever it took to make the bureaucracy respond. The flyover images showed none of this, and while privately Bush was quickly becoming more engaged, it was too little, too late. Over the next couple of days, Dan Bartlett and I struggled with the PR side of the problem. We talked a lot with President Bush about the need to show he was fully engaged in public, but the public policy side of the problem was far more serious, and it was still lacking. Many within the White House were in denial about the administration's responsibility for Katrina. Throughout that first week, we focused on how poorly prepared and overwhelmed state and local officials had been in responding to the storm. This was true, but we largely ignored the fact that the federal government was the vital backup, the fail-safe mechanism supposed to compensate for breakdowns at the lower levels. When you're president, the buck stops with you, a lesson George W. Bush still hadn't fully absorbed. Back at the White House on Wednesday afternoon, the president chaired the first meeting of a newly formed cabinet-level White House task force on Katrina. "We will be dealing with this for a long time," he said at the start of the meeting. He continued, Coordinating responsibility closely with state and local officials is important. There are issues on the ground we must deal with. We need to make sure we know who is in charge, who is running the show on the ground. I just spoke with Louisiana Governor Kathleen Blanco and told her if she wants it to be us, then we will run the show. It is a terrible disaster. Parts of Mississippi are just wiped out. It's beyond description. In New Orleans, neighborhoods are gone. We are talking about rebuilding a city. It is indescribable how terrible it is.